Voyage to Freedom. A Story of the Atlantic Crossing, 1620. Written and read by David Gay. Voyage to Freedom. Introduction. You're standing on a narrow quayside waiting to board a small sailing ship. You're about to make an exciting but dangerous and uncomfortable voyage. I want you to pause just for a moment or two. There are a few things I want you to know about the story of the voyage you're about to take. I want you to have a look at the little ship, its passengers and crew, and I want you to know the reason for making such a journey. The first thing I want you to know is that the story is true. That is, it is based on historical fact. It tells the exciting story of the historic voyage of the 100 or so pilgrims who crossed the Atlantic Ocean in 1620. Master Reynolds, John Howland, and William Button all existed. It is a true story. But, of course, we do not have a detailed record of all that went on during the voyage. We do not know all that was said. I have tried to weave a story around four imaginary characters, the Lovelace family, to show what the voyage must have been like. It happened very much as I have tried to show it. The voyage was hard, and very, very dangerous. I have tried to show you how hard a time the pilgrims had. The ship was very tiny. The QE2, for example, I was writing this in the early 1980s, the QE2, for example, is 66,000 tons. The Mayflower was only 180 tons. If you can imagine six or seven family cars packed nose to tail, that is how long or short she was, and only about four cars wide. And yet she carried 100 passengers and 20 or so crew. A crossing of the Atlantic in recent times would only take a few days. The Mayflower took 9 weeks. The passengers were crammed into a very tiny wooden sailing ship without proper rooms, food, air, beds, or sanitation. It must have been horrible. They passed through storms. They were cheated and abused. They were blown off course. Nor must we forget that it was a tremendous risk to take. They left their familiar and friendly homes and crossed the ocean to a new, unknown, and dangerous land. Remember, the longest journey most people undertook in those days was less than 30 miles from their homes, and at the speed of a horse. The pilgrims sailed 3,000 miles. Why did they do it? The pilgrims were Puritans. They wished to worship God simply. No special buildings, no special robes, no candles, no altars, no prayer books. They wished to worship God according to the way he had told them in his word, the Bible. To do this, they had to leave England. The laws of the land at that time would not allow them to worship God according to the Bible and their conscience. They put God and his word first in their lives, before their comfort or safety. They would endure anything and everything to obey God's laws. God did not fail them. He protected them and took them safely to their new home. In such a voyage in those days, it was very common for many of the passengers to die. Not one of the pilgrims died. In fact, one, Oceanus, was born during the crossing. And now the story is in front of you. I hope you enjoy it. I hope you feel something of the fears and hopes of young justice and prudence. I hope you learn of the God the story speaks of. May we all be true pilgrims. Fare you well as you embark on this great adventure. 1. Getting ready. It was the August of 1620. The waterfront at Southampton was alive with the bustle and chatter of men carrying stores aboard the little rowing boats tied alongside. Boats already filled with the rope-tied chests and battered boxes were making their way out into the bay to two ships, anchored there. Some were already alongside, and sailors, straining on the ropes, were pulling their precious cargoes out of the rowing boats and up onto the decks of the sea-going vessels. The men carrying the cargoes to the rowing boats had to pass a sailor, who checked their loads against a list fluttering in his hand. There were barrels and studded chests, mysterious bundles of every shape and size, salt and salt beef, cheese and dried peas, nails and screws, hammers, saws, axes and muskets, biscuits and drinking water, coils of rope and barrels of tar, squawking chickens and grunting, squealing pigs, snapping dogs straining at their leash. The list must have seemed endless, and so did the trail of dusty-mouthed and tired-limbed men winding its way back along the quay. The human snake twisted its tortuous way to the top of the well-worn, rickety and dripping steps, and down onto the waiting rowing boats, as they bobbed up and down upon the water. Tall, toppling houses pressed toward the sea from the town, vying with one another to see which could lean the furthest over the narrow quay, before casting themselves and their occupants into the deep. There was little room on the narrow wharf at the best of times, and this certainly was not one of those. The cobbled jetty teemed with humanity. Out in the bay, the Speedwell and the Mayflower pulled at their anchors in the rising tide. Seagulls wheeled about them, screaming as they dipped to the water. The breeze fluttered the colourful flags of the ships, and their wild flapping added to the general din. All was a blur of colour and a racket of yapping, snapping dogs, creaking carts, and hollering men. The air was heavy with the smell of salt and stale fish. Two old sailors with faces like weathered walnuts, worn brown with years of gazing into sun and salt sea, were leaning over the rail overlooking the quay. They stood with a knot of idling sailors, too old to put to sea again, who were wasting their time away as they watched the hive of activity below them. Men, women, children, soldiers, and sailors were crushed together with dozens of dogs, goats, and pigs all crowded on to the tiny cobbled quay. "Where are the ships making for?" said one sailor, his worn-out face cracking as he spoke. "Virginia," his friend replied with croaky voice. "Wherever's that?" asked the first. "It's one of the colonies in America." "Why ever is that speck of a ship going all that way?" snorted his friend, as he pointed to the smaller of the two sea-going vessels. "Speedwell, is that her name?" he went on. "I should say that's a good name for that ship. Speedwell, indeed." He slapped the back of his friend, and his remark drew a guffaw of agreement from the others. "She won't be going at speed to America if I know anything about the sea. I reckon she'll do well enough to get past Land's End. Her mast is far too big, if you ask me. And look, she's carrying far too many sails for that small hull, I know." "No," he said aggressively. But no one was in a mind to oppose him. "She'll never get that lot to Virginia. The Mayflower, the other one, she looks more like it, but not that Speedwell." After a pause, he continued with a wondering sound to his voice. "Anyway, it's very strange. I can't take it in. It beats me. Why ever is it that a bunch of Dutch people are coming to Southampton to set sail to go all that way? Why do they want to live over the seas? Ain't they got enough room in Holland?" "They aren't Dutch," replied his crony. "You know they're English." "But didn't I hear they've come from Leyden?" "Ah, that's right enough. But I tell you, they're English. You know, it's that so-called group of pilgrims that want to go and settle in America. They're the ones who've hired the vessels." A shaky arm with pointed finger was raised towards the Speedwell again. I still say that that Spiwa will never get there. You mark my words, said he, with the most definite ring to his voice. She's rigged all wrong. Anyway, you know who the captain is, don't you? He didn't wait for an answer, but carried on over a chorus of eyes. Yeah, that's right, said he, with a smile on his leathery cheeks and a knowing nod. Is that Master Reynolds? You can guess his game, can't you? You can reckon he's up to no good. He'll have made a pretty penny out of the pilgrims. A pilgrim's gold is as good as any to him, and you can be sure of that. Holy gold or wicked, 'twill make no difference. This brought another laugh from the sailor band about him. Well, I don't know all about that, came the reply, but I do know they're trying to get to Virginia. They say they want to set up their homes over there, and they want more of their friends to come to them from Holland. That's the story, so far as I've heard tell. Why do they want to go to America to live? You say they're English. Wherever can't they set up here, then? If they're English, what were they doing in Leyden in the first place? What are folks coming to these days, I say? Matey, I explained that to you just now, said his friend, somewhat losing his patience. They're pilgrims. He took on his best schoolmaster air, plucked at the fingers of his left hand with the forefinger of his right, making his points of argument as he proceeded. You see, they say they want to worship God in the way they see in the Bible. They want to worship God in a simple way. They don't believe the way we've been told is right. They're against the ways our laws tell them to worship, and they want to go and live somewhere else where they can be free to do as they feel right. That's why they went to Holland in the first place. But now they want to live in their own country. They want to run their own affairs. They say they want to be free to worship God as they see in the Bible. Do you get it now? You must have seen them carrying their great Bibles about. Surely you've heard all about the talk they make about their conscience. Haven't you heard them making their speeches about living according to the Bible and in the light of their conscience and such like? Conscience, the second man interrupted, not liking to be treated as a naughty child who had failed to learn his lessons. Conscience! They must be fools and fanatics. This drew another bout of backslapping and guffaws from the crowd. And they've made a bad mistake, all right, in taking on that Master Reynolds. You mark my words. He'll lighten their pockets. If the English pilgrims try to sail to America, in that Speedwell they're heading for a watery grave. She'll never get there. You mark my words. She'll never get there. Just then a tall, lean man came striding down the quay, making his way through the thronging crowd. Although the crowd was thick and noisy, the man had such a manner about him that he easily made his way through the throng. He gently pushed aside the people hindering him until he stood at the head of the steps leading to the rowing boats. He was a fine, upright man, with a clean-shaven face and a strong, pointed chin. He had a bright sparkle in his clear eyes. He had a serious manner about him, and a determined look to his mouth. Even his clothes fitted his bearing, for he wore no gaudy tunic. He was most plainly dressed in a simple black cloak. His legs, covered with tight, dark stockings, suddenly disappeared into short black boots. Towering above his head stood a tall, wide-brimmed black hat. His hair, so short compared to the long, curly manes of the sailors, poked neatly just beneath his hat. Around his neck he had a spotless white collar, and in his hand he carried a large, smooth-worn black leather book. At his side, standing up to the level of his shoulder, stood a lady, also very plainly dressed. She wore a long, flowing apron, pure white, that almost reached to her ankles. This apron rode over the soft folds of a neat black dress that covered her arms and peeped below the apron, just above her tiny black shoes. Her head was covered with a snow-white cap that hid all her hair. Her face shone, highlighted by the surrounding whiteness of her cap. Her tender eyes were alive with excitement. Her worn hands were clasped tightly before her. Just behind the parents, two children were eagerly chattering to each other. When they stopped their chatter for a moment, they still had their mouths wide open, drinking in all they could see. They seemed to be lost in the seething mass of legs about them. They were in danger of being dragged away by the crowd and trampled. They kept their position by their parents only by their strong, clutching grip upon their mother's fulsome skirts. The children were dressed like their parents in plain, simple clothes of hard-wearing fustian with peeping white collars and cuffs. The pilgrims seemed to be all black and white. The only colour about them was the pale pink of their faces, as they shone out in brilliance against the sombre background of their clothes. One of the children pointed wildly at the ships. They hugged themselves, screwing themselves tight in their tingling excitement. They were agog with the thrill of it all. The man stepped up to the sailor who held the cargo list in his hand. "Matthew Lovelace," he said in a deep voice, addressing his remark to the sailor and raising his hand briefly to the brim of his hat. "Matthew Lovelace, lately of Leiden in Holland, formerly of Scrooby in Nottinghamshire. Have my belongings been sent aboard the Speedwell yet, may I ask?" The sailor with the cargo list ran his eye over the paper in front of him. "Lovelace," he drawled slowly, "Lovelace, let me see." He spoke wearily. Long hours had he spent at his post, and his hot, tired feet and aching legs called for him for eagerly awaited rest. At last he jabbed his finger at the list and ran it along an imaginary line. "Yes, sir," he came to reply. "Three cases for Matthew Lovelace. One for Martha Lovelace, your wife, and one each for your children, Justice Lovelace and Prudence Lovelace. They were sent aboard, sir, about half an hour ago. Six cases altogether." "Thank you," said Mr. Lovelace. "At what time do we set sail?" "We sail on the afternoon tide, sir. About 3 in the afternoon." "At what time can we go aboard?" "We should be taking on the passengers, sir, about noon." "Very well. We shall be here in good time," he said. With that, he turned his back on the sailor. The four of them, Matthew, Martha, and their two children, Justice and Prudence, picked their way through the crowd almost at once. They disappeared in the surging multitude. Like the very sea itself, the lingering mass of humanity surged back, and the Lovelaces could be seen no more.